It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And it's February. And while that is not good news in a lot of places, it is very good news in baseball world because it means that we are in the month where there will be baseball. 2 weeks from now, there will be workouts. Just about 3 weeks from now, people will be playing games of a sort. In fact, I think 3 weeks from today, we'll have a couple of those college games. So we are up on it. And that means it's time to start our position previews. We'll do that a little later. We'll also be adding a new feature to the 411 this week. So I'm very excited about all of that. And stick around. Let's have some fun. We talked last week that we thought we'd have some transactions to talk about. And we do. So we've got some fun stuff. It starts with Christian Yelich, who goes from Miami to Milwaukee. Want to give a shout-out to our friends over at the StatCast podcast. If you're interested in Christian Yelich and interested in this question we're about to address, you should definitely listen to their most recent episode where they go into some depth from a StatCast perspective, talking about Yelich in Milwaukee. But it's an interesting question because, I mean, one, there's some inherent value bump because the Brewers are going to have a way better lineup than the Marlins this year. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago. You didn't want to have whoever the last man standing in Miami is. It looks like that's Real Muto right now. But from a performance perspective, here's the question. And Fred, this is what I posed to you, and this is what they talked about on the StatCast podcast. Is Yelich the kind of hitter who really should benefit that much from moving to from Miami to Milwaukee? Because he doesn't elevate the ball. He might get a few more home runs. And we can talk about lineup context, too. But do you think people are overstating the potential power boost he might get changing from Marlins Park to Miller Park?
I can see that angle for sure, in the sense of, you know, and I'm sure they discussed it, that he doesn't hit a lot of fly balls. And to take advantage of the park effect, you need to hit a lot of fly balls to take advantage of you know, shorter distances or whatever your park offers. That being said, if we just look at the raw stats from his career, in his career, he's hit 59 home runs and 41 have come on the road. So there does seem to be an argument there that his approach was different when he was away from Marlins Park, or the parks themselves were helping him. But I think it's fair to maybe give him a small boost in potential home runs. So if we were thinking of him, he hit 21 two years ago and 18 last year. So if we were thinking of him as roughly a 20 homer hitter, to think maybe he can push into the 20s a little further, maybe 23 or something like that. But I'm not willing to say that now all of a sudden he's going to hit 27 home runs this year. Do you think it's fair to give him a little boost, but maybe not go overboard as far as power goes?
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. And the other question, and to kind of contradict myself, but, you know, this is the other question. Elevating the ball is no longer a secret, right? This is not something where, you know, a couple of years ago, Daniel Murphy started doing this and everybody said, oh, whoa, what's he doing? This is now kind of a thing people do. So Christian Yelich knows about it. And if you talk to some people, it's sort of been raised to him and he's been reluctant to do it. The question is, I don't think you can draft or bid based on this kind of speculation. But I think it's at least possible that part of what was going on was he looked at Marlins Park and said, man, I'm not going to try that. That's not going to work for me. And that maybe in a place where elevating the ball is going to help it get out, maybe he will be a little more open to that idea. I don't know if you can do more than wonder. You know, I don't think you can really count on that. But I wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah, to me, this whole move just it recaptures Yelich's value. It stabilizes it. It kind of puts it back to maybe where it was before the Marlins had their fire sale. As far as, you know, the Marlins, people think of Yelich, okay, he's leaving a really bad lineup. Well, not really, because he never played in a really bad lineup. He played around D. Gordon, Giancarlo Stanton, and Marcelo Ozuna last year in the top of that lineup. He's going to a team that should have a good top of the lineup, but it won't be any better than that. So to me, this stabilizes his value. I agree with you. I think if he hits more fly balls, that could get him a few more home runs. Maybe he does push up to 25 home runs. However, that could, and we saw this a little bit with Francisco Lindor last year, those extra home runs and those extra fly balls, maybe that takes away a little bit of his stolen bases, which now It's a bit of a wash in fantasy value. The Brewers have always been fairly aggressive running the bases in recent years. So I feel comfortable saying maybe about 23 home runs. He's been around. He's in 16 steals two of the past three seasons. I think that I feel pretty safe saying 16, maybe even 17 or so. To me, it makes him a nice like fifth, sixth round pick, and you just don't have to worry much about him anymore.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. I think maybe it raises the floor on Yelich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a variety of reasons, both the lineup, but also, you know, if that team's really bad, a good veteran player might really be in a bad headspace. So I think that's another thing to at least have in the back of your mind. But Yelich was not the only move the Brewers made. They also signed Lorenzo Cain. We'll go next directly to Cain. This is a guy who might benefit from the change in ballpark, from a quietly difficult place to hit for power, though a place that's pretty friendly to speed players, to a place that's not so bad to hit for power, and probably is going to a better lineup. I kind of like Cain in Milwaukee. In fact, I kind of like Cain a lot in Milwaukee. How much of a boost does he get from this move?
Yeah, I think a small boost. I think of all the free agent landing spots, this was a good one for him. I expect that he'll be their leadoff hitter. Putting him as leadoff on a National League team, that probably somewhat mutes his RBI total. I mean, he's not Charlie Blackmon, so I think he's going to have, you know, if he hits 15, maybe 18, 19 home runs, I think he'll have an RBI total maybe around 60. I mean, that's something he's only done once so far in his career. I think he can steal 25 to 30 bases, as I mentioned, the Brewers run. I think he can hit 300. I think he can score 90 runs. With Cain, it also, though, really does come down to durability. And I'm someone who probably owns Cain as much as just about anyone in fantasy leagues in the last few years. So I know that he's not a huge injury risk. That being said, he's only played in more than 140 games once in his career.
And that leads into the other question here, which is a bigger picture one with the Brewers. They have an army of pretty good to excellent outfielders. They have the two new acquisitions. They have Domingo Santana. They have a guy named Ryan Braun you may have heard of. They have Keon Broxton. They have more guys than they have places for them. There's talk about moving Braun to first base some. I am skeptical of that. Everybody's pretty convinced they're going to deal somebody. But, you know, for now, with any of these guys, do you have to presumably accept Cain, who you signed to that kind of deal. You're going to play nearly every day if you can. Do you have to bake in a little uncertainty on playing time for all these guys, even the stars, just because Broxton's probably going to go to the minors, but that still leaves you with four outfielders for three spots. Those guys have to play. Do you dock them all just a little bit on playing time?
To me, Santana's the big loser. I mean, Broxton is in the sense of, Broxton was already on the fringe as the way he finished last season as far as whether you wanted to draft him in a mixed league. So he's out now. I think Yelich and Cain, you know, Cain's are the big contract. Yelich has been quite durable, and they paid a lot in as far as prospects for him. I think they're playing. I think Braun's playing. Like, Ryan Braun's a longtime superstar in Milwaukee with a big, big contract. I think he's playing. I know he typically gets at least one day off a week and once in a while too, but I think you were already expecting that. So to me right now, unless Braun starts playing two or three games a week at first base, but even if he does, I think Domingo Santana is the big fantasy loser in this. And I really like Santana as a skill set and his potential, but I don't think in a mixed league right now you can draft him as one of your starting players, looking at him as potentially their fourth outfielder. I mean, if you're drafting right now, you could draft him late, hoping that he gets traded or Braun gets traded or something like that. But I don't feel comfortable drafting him as someone who I'm counting on in a mixed league. Do you agree with that? Like, do you think that he's the one who's the most likely to get dinged just due to maybe stature in the organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that. But look, the flip side of that is I think he's also the guy most likely to get traded. You know, I mean, I've sort of just talking to people, talking baseball, you sort of entertain the idea of Ryan Braun going somewhere. I've talked to a couple friends about, you know, doesn't it kind of add up in an interesting way if something like a Ryan Braun for Zach Greinke or something built around that. But, you know, I think in reality, Braun's going to be harder to deal. He is an icon. He probably has less value to another club than he does to the Brewers. And what they really want right now is a legitimate front-of-the-rotation starting pitcher, not necessarily a true ace. But they want somebody, they basically want their opening day starter, I think is a fair way to put it. I think Joe Sheehan may have written that recently, that they want the guy who's starting their first game. Well, Santana seems like the guy who can get you that. And so the one thing about Santana is I feel like he's the one guy who is most likely to get dealt somewhere and play a lot. You know, if that's the Rays, if that's Cleveland, whatever it might be, you know, he seems like really interesting trade bait. And so, you know, you can't count on that. But the other possibility with Santana, he's got this wide range right now, is I guess the point, is he could be the fourth outfielder or he could be somebody's prized trade acquisition. And that has a pretty significant effect on his value, whichever one of those he ends up being.
Yeah, I think my thought on Santana, you know, previously I thought he would be fine as probably your second outfielder, like a really high, like top 10 rounds of a mixed league draft. Now he could still be that. I mean, if you're drafting in late March, you'll probably know. If I was drafting right. soon, I think you draft him as your fourth or fifth type outfielder, yep. where he's easily replaceable. Hopefully, I think the Indians makes a lot of sense just for me looking at all the options. I feel like the Indians would make a lot of sense as far as the needs of both teams. But we'll see. I don't run either team, so it's probably not going to happen. But like that, if that happens, then you've got a top 10 round value that you just took in round 20. And if it doesn't happen, then I think you just stick him on your bench and
right.
wait, because Braun is injury prone, and then all of a sudden he's yeah. in the starting lineup.
The other part of that deal, several prospects. Marlins actually got a really good haul in this one. And the other key piece for fantasy purposes is Lewis Brinson. I am a little cooler on Brinson than some people. I think he's really intriguing. You know, I certainly think he could have some real fantasy value, but I think it's worth being aware that we are not talking about a Byron Buxton type number one, number two overall prospect, a Justin Upton. We're not talking about one of those kind of guys. He was the Brewers' best prospect. He is now the Marlins' best prospect, and he's an intriguing player. But I don't know how high the ceiling is, and I don't know how high the floor is. So I like him as a sleeper, but I think maybe he's going to get overdrafted, and I think maybe he's a guy that I'm willing to let somebody else overdraft. Do you see him differently, or do you think maybe that's a fair assessment?
No, I think that's fair, and we have to take everything we said about Yelich and reverse it now talking about
right.
Brinson, where his home park's going to suppress his power, which isn't elite, but he does have 15 homer-type power. You know, his home park's not going to help him get there quickly. His lineup is not going to help him just accidentally produce nice totals and runs and RBIs. I think the potential in Brinson, he's going to play. I think unless the Marlins go out and sign two or three veterans just right on the verge of spring training to those little one-year contracts, other than that, I think they don't have other outfield options. He's going
right.
to play every day. He should steal you 15 to 20 bases. You hope his batting average is at least close to what your team's is so he doesn't hurt you too much. In that regard, in a 15-team league, I think he's a late-round pick. In an NL-only league, I think he has some value there. He's worth a few dollars in an auction to get those steals. But the lineup, the home park, everything around him, it all really limits his upside, plus the factor of like whether or not he's really ready to produce in the majors.
Yeah. And you mentioned the lineup, and that's a really key thing. I mean, the Marlins, and we've talked about this before, I hinted at it just a couple minutes ago, the Marlins lineup has lost a lot of good pieces and has gone from probably a better lineup than it got credit for to a lineup where there are really only a couple guys you have any interest in at all. And so the first thing to raise here is, where's JT Realmuto's value right now, assuming he stays in Miami, because there is going to be nobody to drive in and nobody to drive him in.
Yeah, I know that. I still think he's a top five catcher, and I have seen people jumping off Realmuto. The reason I think he's still a top five catcher, I had him fourth at prior to all these moves. I'm kind of still inclined to keep him there. When I look at the catchers who I have right below him, well, one, Salvador Perez, and how good is the Royals lineup really looking right
yeah,
now? I mean,
fair.
If it's better than the Marlins, not by much. The next one's Wilson Ramos. how good is the Rays lineup looking right now? I may rather have Evan Gattis if the Astros are really committing to him as their regular DH. Now he's in so much of a better lineup. But if Real Muto can get 15 to 20 homers, and he can steal you almost around 10 bases, 8, 9, 10 bases, and there's also the possibility that even if he opens the season as a member of the Marlins, that he's on another team by the trade deadline. Just because they don't trade him by opening day, it's quite possible that someone could trade for him during the season, and you could have him hitting on a contender. I also know that the lineup's going to be really bad, but at least he's going to hit probably second. Or like, if I'm kind of guessing that lineup, maybe it goes Castro, Real Muto, Justin Bour. It's not a good lineup, to be sure, but at least he's going to hit in one of the best spots in it.
Speaking of Bour, do you have any mixed league interest in him at this point with basically, again, except maybe Real Muto, nobody to drive in?
Yeah, I'm still holding a little bit of interest. Like, in a 12-team league, I could see maybe taking him late. In a 15-team league, I'm interested for sure. The problem with Bour is that now the ceiling is so capped that in a shallow league, like in a 10-team league, if you're going to draft someone like Bour in the last round, you might as well just draft someone in a better lineup or draft someone with higher upside. You know, go and draft Chris Davis from the Orioles or something like that late in your draft, because at least he's got that 40 homer upside if he gets back on track. You know, draft Greg Bird late, because at least he's in a great lineup if things really click for him. I think Bour has more value in the deep leagues, because although he's not going to be awesome, he's going to play, you know, he'll probably get his 75 RBIs. He'll probably hit you high 20s, if not 30 home runs. So there's something there, but the first base being so deep and his upside being so limited, I think that takes him off the 10-team and maybe even 12-team list for me.
You posed an interesting question in our notes, and my initial reaction was, why are we talking about this guy? And then I went back and looked, and I said, oh, that's what we're talking about. And this guy is Jose Reyes. Jose Reyes was not a great major league player last year. He was a pretty good fantasy infielder. You can use him a couple different spots. He still has a little power. He still has a little speed. How shallow a league do you think Jose Reyes has value in, with the acknowledgement that, look, the Mets are saying the same thing they said last year, which is, he's a utility guy, we're going to sign a second baseman. That's fine. They were saying the same thing a year ago, and Jose Reyes led them in plate appearances. So with that fact in your back pocket, how much value does Jose Reyes have right now?
Yeah, a 10-team league, I'm out. 12-team league, it would kind of depend on my late-round options and what my team looked like. The fact that Reyes is going to start the year eligible at second, third, and short makes him a really nice bench player. You know, you can plug him into a lot of spots. Someone goes down with an injury, or someone's just having an off, has a day off, and you can put him in, hope that he gets some stolen bases, maybe even a home run from him. I think in a 12-team league, he's an interesting bench option. The problem with him as a bench option in April is that his upside is so limited that you're probably better off take a younger player with some upside at least for a few weeks and see if it works out. And if not, then you grab someone like Reyes from the waiver wire. But I think in 15-team leagues, if the Mets don't add a second baseman, no matter what they say, I think he's going to play a lot and probably steal you 20 bases. So I think there is a little bit of value there. And the Mets organization likes Jose Reyes. They are happy to have him. I know we don't see him as an exciting fantasy option anymore, but not many middle infielders hit 15 home runs and swipe 25 or 24 bases last year.
Right, that's the thing. It's those counting stats that make him pretty intriguing. Staying with the Mets, they continue to say that they are going to go closer by committee. I am on record with what I think about closer by committee, which is, on the one hand, I think it's a really good idea, and on the other hand, I never believe anybody when they say it. I think somebody is going to be the Mets closer. I don't know. I think this is just setting them up. Here's my read as to why they're saying it. And it's not that they actually want to do it. It's that they don't have the faith in Familia. And so what's going to happen, I think, is they're going to give Familia a few chances, and they're going to give Ramos a few chances. And if Familia shows that he's really the kind of guy they can have faith in, he'll emerge as the guy, and Ramos will set up. If he doesn't, then Ramos will be the guy. But I strongly doubt that there will be, like, three guys with 10 or 12 saves on the Mets. I think somebody emerges as the guy. So, one, do you buy the thing I always say? And two, if that's the case, who do you like emerging as the one guy by May 1st or June 1st or whenever it is?
Yeah, if I had to, you know, handicap the battle, I would still take Familia, even though I don't think it's anything close to a lock. It could create if you really feel like it, Familia or Ramos, and they're the two with the ninth inning experience. Like Anthony Swarzak is coming off a really nice season, and the Mets have signed him, but he's not an experienced closer. If you're right on your read of the situation where they're kind of taking the commitment away from Familia until they see how he looks, then it creates an interesting fantasy buying opportunity where maybe as late as the bench rounds in a 12-team league and definitely in a 10-team league, you could draft Familia and Ramos back-to-back, keep them both for the first 3 weeks of the season, and then hope that someone emerges and then cut the other one. And you're frustrated if no one emerges and they actually are the first team to really commit to a closer committee all year. But I think there's an interesting fantasy buying opportunity here, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would note if I'm trying to come at this from all angles and sort of trying to find the hole in my own logic is this is a new manager. And it's a manager who's a pitching coach, and it's a manager who has handled some bullpens in unconventional ways in the postseason. So is it impossible that they would be the first ones to say it and really mean it? Oh, it's not impossible. I'm just really skeptical. But I think your approach is the right one, which is sort of cover your bases, and if you can get a couple of those guys late and cover yourself, that's a nice position to be in. One last piece of news. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and what's the worst case is they actually do split the save chances and you just end up cutting, say, your 26th and 27th round picks at the end of April, and you probably would have cut them anyways or been pretty much on the fence for cutting them.
Yeah. One last piece of news this week. Manny Machado is going to be the Orioles shortstop. I don't think you can draft him as a shortstop, but he'll be eligible there pretty quickly. Does it do anything significant for his value, do you think?
I don't think so. I think that the knee-jerk reaction from fantasy owners that I saw on social media was that, you know, this made him more valuable. I think that's a little bit old school thinking. I don't think they're in mixed leagues right now. I don't think there is much position scarcity, if any at all. And even when you look at where he's not the best shortstop. You know, Trey Turner's being drafted as the top shortstop. Last year, Machado had shortstop eligibility. He was roughly the 10th best shortstop. I think he'll be better than that this year, but there's nothing to say that he'll be better than Francisco Lindor or Carlos Correa. I could make a great case for drafting either or one of them or both in front of him. So he deepens the middle infield pool, which is nice. But to me, it doesn't change. If you viewed Machado as a second rounder, he's still a second rounder. If you're more bullish on him than I am and you viewed him as a late first rounder, then he's still a late first rounder. But to me, the shortstop eligibility doesn't really change much. Nice tiebreaker. That's, I think, the most I'd say about it.
So we're starting, as I hinted at the beginning, we're starting something new this week. We are going to start taking a couple of questions each episode. Going forward, please use the hashtag AskThe411. That will ensure that we both see it. We can discuss some of these things in advance. We can make sure we get good questions. But there's a lot of interest, and we definitely want to have some interaction with all of you, our listeners. So I'm looking forward to doing these. Please do not just send us trade proposals. That kind of stuff is not really all that valuable. Stuff that we can sort of dig into a little bit here and get into some depth and answer some questions that might be valuable to people. We have a couple of good ones this week. But again, going forward, hashtag AskThe411 on the Twitter machine. From Corey, am I better off keeping Jose Abreu or Rafael Devers? These guys are closer than I thought in taking a look. Part of this is, if this is a long-term keeper, if this is somebody you might have next year and the year after that, that argues for Devers. But Abreu had a really nice year last year. He seems to have a really high floor. And I don't know about the White Sox. I kind of have a hunch they could be kind of interesting. But I think he's safer even in the questionable lineup. Which of those two guys do you like more?
Yeah, one of the reasons I picked this is actually so I could give everyone some question-asking advice beyond even the Ask the 411 questions that we're going to get, even the questions that I get in the regular Fantasy 411 Twitter chats. If you're asking keeper questions, try to put in at least a few words about how long you can keep these players for. If this is a traditional keeper where you're keeping these players for, say, 3 years or less, I'll take Jose Abreu over Rafael Devers for the next 3 years. If this is the dynasty-type format where you're keeping them forever or close to forever, then I would take Devers. But in a traditional keeper, I agree. I think even with the White Sox lineup likely being a lot worse than the Red Sox lineup, I think I would still keep Abreu just for that incredible consistency we've seen from him so far.
And our second question comes from Bill Rome. A little more Christian Yelich. With Yelich in Milwaukee, would you draft him ahead of Reese Hoskins? Which is kind of interesting because they're such different players. But I think that Hoskins' power, and look, I think he comes back a little bit, but, you know, that's something we talked about last year. He had 38 home runs in Double A the year before. He has big-time power. And, you know, I think that that lineup core in Philly is going to provide him RBI opportunities. So, you know, I'd take Hoskins before I'd take Yelich. But I also know that you sometimes value those sort of moderate steals guys more than I do. So I suspect you may disagree with me on this one.
I don't, actually. I think I'm higher than most people on Hoskins, and that may be the reason. As you mentioned, he has big-time power. What he also has is big-time control over the strike zone. And this is someone who will put up, you know, last season as a rookie, 46 strikeouts, 37 walks. Like, that is a terrific walk-to-strikeout ratio for any player, especially a player so young. If he can control the strike zone even similar to that this season, I think he's going to be great, you know, right off the top in his first full season. So I'm really bullish on Hoskins. I think he's being drafted, say, around 50th overall in his ADP right now. I would be willing to put him even higher than that. I keep trying to pull myself back because you don't want to get too excited over a 50-game sample, but he could have been a lot worse than that 50-game sample, and you could still prorate it and have a really awesome, you know, fourth or fifth round pick. So I'm pretty bullish on Hoskins for this year. I think he's one of the few candidates in baseball. There's a bunch, like a handful, but I think he's one of the 40 homer candidates this year.
Yeah, I agree. And again, you know, as I talked about a couple of weeks ago, I think that heart of the Phillies lineup is going to be pretty good. I think there will be opportunities there, focusing on guys who get on base, and there will be opportunities to drive in runs. So thanks, Corey and Bill. And again, everybody, hashtag Ask the 411, and we're going to start taking questions. Make them good. We now move on to our starting pitcher preview, and that is the surest sign that we are really moving towards a new season. It is a four-name top tier. You know, I feel like it's kind of, to some extent, I think this is kind of a reflection of Kershaw's health kind of bringing him back to the field a little bit. But it's a pretty clear top tier, and the question is the order. Like, I don't think there's any question that these four guys stand alone. The question is the order. Kershaw, Scherzer, Kluber, Sale. If I tell you that even despite the occasional nagging thing, Scherzer's durability, consistent durability, and the fact that Kershaw's injuries are back injuries, which are scary and don't tend to go away completely, that because of that, I like Scherzer the most of the starting pitchers. Am I completely nuts to think that?
You're not. I mean, the margin between all four of these pitchers is really thin. So I don't think you are. I still like Kershaw the best, just because I think he's the one, and this one's probably obvious, but he's the one who has the ability to run away with it. He's the one who has the ability to have 220 innings and a high ones, which he's done, you know, ERA, and the other three don't. So I like Kershaw the best. I acknowledge the risk of them. I spent a ton of time on these four pitchers because it's just something that really interests me, and trying to separate them because it's easy to say they're all in tier one. But if you have the 10th pick in your draft and you want to take one of them, you probably have your choice between two or three of them. So you need to separate them. I actually put Scherzer at the back. The reason I put him at the back was the combination of the nagging injuries late last season, the finger injury that he started last season with, him being the oldest member of the group, and him having the most mileage on him in the last few years. So for that reason, I felt like maybe he was a little riskier than Sale and Kluber, but it's really splitting hairs. I feel really safe with Kluber. I feel like the Indians are going to run away with that division that has three rebuilding teams in it. So I feel like he's just really safe, and Sale's the youngest, so I feel like he's fairly safe in that regard. So you asked me if you were crazy to put Scherzer first. Now I'm going to ask you, do you think I'm crazy to put him last?
I could see him third. I am fairly consistently the low man on Sale, and the strikeouts are ridiculous. But I still look at this guy, and I look at, you know, the 2.90 ERA last year was great. But he was 334 the year before that, 341 the year before that. And I kind of wonder if that's the real sale, if we just saw a career year. That's somewhat informed by the fact that, you know, he had that amazing run and then he kind of cooled off. And I just wonder, look, we are splitting really fine hairs here, and he is clearly four, and I'm not running Chris Sale down. I'm not saying I wouldn't draft him or anything like that. But I feel like the floor for Sale is the lowest of these guys. And if you are taking a starting pitcher with the number 10 overall pick, you need high ceiling and high floor. And I just think his floor is a little lower. He's the one guy that I won't be shocked if his ratios kind of take a step back and he's a 3.5 ERA guy and walks a few more guys and is clearly an ace, but not top 10 overall ace.
We might have just said with what we didn't say that Kluber might be the safest one of all of them. I mean, he's on a great team, like I mentioned, in a division with three rebuilding clubs right now that look like easy pickings for such a good pitcher. He's not the oldest one in the group. He doesn't have the most mileage. He doesn't have a history of arm injuries or anything. So there's just, it's hard to see Kluber beyond a new injury or something. It's hard to see Kluber having a bad season. The Scherzer thing is just me noticing that, you know, John Lester last year, Johnny Cueto last year, you know, Felix Hernandez at one point, like sometimes these pitchers can kind of go south in a hurry. And I wondered about the little injuries last year, but they're all great. I think they're all first round options.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's completely fair. At some point time comes for everybody. And at, you know, 34 this year, certainly could be Scherzer. Tier two to me is nearly always the most interesting place for starting pitchers because, you know, that's where you get the guys who, you know, some of these guys for a lot of teams are going to be your number one pitcher. Some teams are going to be your number two. And most of these guys come with some kind of risk. Strasburg, Bumgarner, Carrasco, Verlander, Severino, DeGrom. You know, I think we're both pretty consistent in our regard for Strasburg and Bumgarner. I'm really confident based on what I saw late in the year from Bumgarner. The question I want to ask you out of this bunch, because to me it's the biggest contrast, two guys right by each other that you have right by each other within this tier, Verlander, Severino. You know, Severino probably has the higher ceiling. He almost certainly has the higher floor, almost certainly has the higher risk factor. How do you look at those two guys who in some ways are very similar as far as how you value them for fantasy and in some ways are completely different?
Yeah, I think Severino versus almost any of the other pitchers, because all the other ones in this tier have more track record. I think it's really just how you feel about Severino. His combination of ground ball rate and strikeout rate is really good. I don't fear the AL East that much because he's on the Yankees, and so he doesn't have to face the Yankees lineup. The Red Sox lineup's good. It's not amazing. It's good. The Blue Jays lineup's pretty average. The Orioles lineup's pretty average. The Rays lineup isn't that strong. So, I mean, the parks don't work for him, but the lineups aren't that bad. I like Severino. I think the ceiling's really high. And the bullpen behind him will be so good for protecting leads. The offense can get him leads. For Verlander, I wonder how much the Astros are going to manage him this season a little bit. He is an older pitcher who just pitched all the way to the end of October. Houston has incredible pitching depth right now with guys like Colin McHugh and Brad Peacock not even in their rotation. I wonder if they'll manage Verlander a bit and he'll be a little less of a workhorse, maybe just a barely 200 innings type pitcher who they save some for October. Do you think that's a possibility with him?
Wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised. I think that would be a perfectly reasonable thing. You know, I think that is a thing we're going to see more and more from smart teams with money that can afford depth. I think we're going to see more of that. I think that's probably, it already seems to be the way we're trending. I mean, to some extent, it's the way we're trending with back of the rotation starters. But I think if you can, and these clubs that look pretty safe to be playing in October, I think you're going to see more of that.
Now, out of the tier two, are there a couple pitchers that jump out to you where you think, yeah, that if I miss out on one of the big four, like if I'm waiting until kind of round three, these are the couple guys I'm targeting?
Yeah, I mean, it's the guy on at the top of the list. I mean, I you know, as we've talked about before, I'm a big Strasburg fan. I know the injury risk, but I still think I'm I can't, to some extent, it's illogical because I can look 127 innings, 147 innings, 175 innings, but I still, you know, he hasn't had really had arm issues. It's sort of been weird stuff. I like Strasburg a lot. I like Bumgarner a lot. To me, those two guys kind of step out. I mean, Carrasco's ceiling is incredibly high. You know, and DeGrom to me, I mean, I like the way you have these guys ordered because DeGrom to me worries me a little for reasons I can't quite explain. Maybe it's just met by association. You know, but he's the kind of, he's the one of those guys that kind of concerns me most. Also, he got a 3.5 ERA last year. He was not the same guy that was so dominant back in 15.
Yeah, I'm kind of, the more I look into this tier, the more I like Carrasco.
Yeah.
Obviously great skills. It's for the same reasons that I mentioned Kluber being really safe. Like,
right.
I just think in the AL Central, a really talented pitcher like Carrasco on the Indians can have a really nice season. And I think there's some injury risk there. I think he is more of an injury risk, for example, than Bumgarner, but maybe has a little higher ceiling just because of his situation right now with the Indians. And then has a higher floor than Strasburg. Although Strasburg has a higher ceiling, I think Carrasco has a little higher floor. So
right.
I think he's maybe a neat mix of the two. And I totally agree with you on DeGrom. I think it is a little bit just things haven't gone well with Steven Matz, Matt Harvey, Noah Syndergaard, and DeGrom's managed to walk by that mostly, but you wonder at some point.
Tier three, Greinke, Syndergaard, Darvish, Quintana, Archer, Ray, Carlos Martinez, Nola, James Paxton, Dallas Keuchel. So another pair of guys you have right by each other that I kind of want to dig into a little bit. Syndergaard, Darvish. That's a really interesting pair of guys to have right by each other because, boy, Syndergaard could be – Syndergaard's one of these guys that we could be talking about in Tier 1 next year. And he has that kind of ability that – he could be so dominant that if he makes 32 starts at level he can make, he's a guy where we're talking about, do you like him more than Sale this time next year? I mean that. I mean, we all know my fondness for watching Syndergaard, but that's the kind of ability he has. We have not seen that ceiling from Darvish in a very long time, but he has shown it at times, and he has pitched more innings than Syndergaard. So how do you kind of look at those two guys relative to each other?
I think until Darvish signs, I would rather have Syndergaard. And right now, for me, it's not close. I think Syndergaard's the one who, to me, is like really already bordering on that tier two. It's just how many innings can you project for him? I mean, I think 184 is his career. It was 2 years ago, 30 last year. You know, I kind of tentatively put him in at around 165, 170. If you want to go all the way to 185, I think Syndergaard actually belongs in Tier 2 because I don't think there's much question that he's really, really good when he's pitching. With Darvish, I do have that question a little bit after last year. If Darvish signed, say Darvish went back to the Rangers, I would put him near the back end of this tier. If Darvish went back to the Dodgers, I would put him at the front end of this tier. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Tier 4, Tanaka. Cole, who is no longer still a Pirate. I started to say, because I was still thinking about the Yankee trade, who is still a Pirate, but he's not a Yankee. He's an Astro. Kyle Hendricks, John Lester, David Price, Shohei Ohtani, Jake Arrieta, Luke Weaver, Johnny Cueto, Jeff Samardzija. Man, this group is all over the map. There are high floor guys. There are high ceiling guys. There are who knows what you're going to get guys. Who are some of the guys, as you were putting this together, that you found the most challenging as far as how to place them?
Yeah, I think you're right about this group. So when I was writing the starting pitcher article that'll come out in a couple of weeks on our site and working on it, I've never seen a tier, I think, at any position with more volatility than this group of 10 pitchers. Like, it just the range for guys like Lester and Price and Ohtani. It's like usually within a tier, I look for, okay, there's some boomer bust guys, and then there's also some really safe ones. With this tier, I think maybe other than Hendricks, it's just boomer bust all over the map. Garrett Cole, I came out pretty favorably after he was traded the Astros. I think now I'm pretty much at the front end of the – I have him at the front end of the tier. And Tanaka, I'm also a pretty big believer in Luke Weaver's skills, so I think he's someone I would like to invest in. I think when I look at tier four – it really reminds me that, especially in 10 and 12 team leagues, you probably want to come out of those first three tiers, which covers 20 pitchers, with at least two. You want two of those from the first three tiers. If you're going to try to wait and anchor your rotation with a couple of guys from tier four, like, you're really, really rolling the dice. And then I think I'm not feeling great about Price or Arrieta or Lester. Not really that excited about jumping back in on Lester. What about you? Which one, like, really kind of you thought, oh, okay, I'll take that guy as my number two or three starter, and which ones do you think, I don't think I'm touching that one this year?
Man, I mean, this is a group where I will be seriously thinking about, am I just more comfortable doing something else at this point and looking at one of those just outside the top tiers guys that we talked about recently. I like Tanaka pretty well. I like Hendricks pretty well. I have no idea what to make of Ohtani. I'm with you on Weaver. I think he is really interesting. I think if there's one guy from this group that I may like kind of more than conventional wisdom or more than his placement, it's Cueto. I think a healthy Cueto is probably going to be pretty good. I could be wrong, and again, he had a 4-5 ERA last year, so he could be flat bad, but I have a feeling, mostly just based on that he's really rarely been bad, that he's going to be pretty good next year. And so he's a guy that I'd be pretty happy to get down at that spot.
Yeah, and I think as we look at all the volatility in that tier, and there will be one or two pitchers from that tier who are really, really good this year, that's just playing the odds. But I think it should make owners feel pretty secure in just kind of sucking it up and using some of those early round picks on starters, getting at least a couple starters from those top three tiers, like at least one from tier one or two, and then someone from tier three, at least, if not a third one, but at least a couple, because then you could choose to just skip tier four, let other people in your league roll the dice on those players and just take hitters for about three or four straight rounds, and then jump back into the risky pitcher pool, you know, after tier four, when the prices go down a little bit, say around, which depends on league size, whether it's round 9, 12, whatever, depending on your league size. But I wouldn't mind going a little boom or bust with my rotation this year, you know, maybe getting a Strasburg and a Greinke, and then just sitting around and getting hitters, relievers, and waiting, and maybe just missing this tier.
I think that, I mean, I would seriously consider that at that point. I think that at that, because there were some, as we talked about, there were some really interesting names in that next out of the top tiers that we talked about last week. So, or 1 week recently, it might have been last week. That is it for the 411 this week. We will talk to you again next week when we will be single-digit days from workouts beginning, when hopefully we're going to know where Yu Darvish is going. We are ratcheting it right up. And again, questions at hashtag AskThe411. Thanks, everybody, for taking the time to listen. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk. This is the Fantasy 411.